This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, more Black activists than ever are expected to travel to Richmond, Virginia, for a national conference of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, in June. And Cynthia McKinney, the Black former congresswoman and presidential candidate, explains how the Democrats became the loudest advocates of war.
But first, Ajamu Baraka, the Green Party's 2016 vice presidential candidate, is spearheading a campaign to revive the anti-war movement in Black America. Baraka is a co-founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. He says the time is right to launch BAP, the Black Alliance for Peace.
We pushed this out on April the 4th to take advantage of the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's Beyond Vietnam speech, in which, of course, your listeners know this was the point in which Dr. King felt morally compelled to join the chorus of Black resistors who had already expressed their opposition to the Vietnam War, which he was relatively silent on up until that moment on April the 4th, 1967, where he, in fact, broke his silence and said to the world that basically he was morally compelled to stand in solidarity with the shirtless, barefoot people of the world who were struggling for freedom, and that it was important that he join that call and to recognize and identify that the greatest purveyor of violence on the planet and the state responsible for the enormous suffering in Vietnam was, in fact, the United States of America. And so that position, that breaking the silence, made that connection between the domestic struggle for justice and the international solidarity and struggle against oppression, which is a center plank of the Black radical tradition. So in that sense, on April the 4th, 1967, Dr. King reconnected to the Black radical tradition. So we wanted to take advantage of that 50 years later to call for a new articulation, in some ways maybe a continued one, opposing the still greatest purveyor of violence on this planet, the United States of America, and calling for a renewed Black anti-war position and anti-war movement. So we have pushed this out. The response has been tremendous. There's nothing like that that is out there right now. And we are attempting to link up with organizations and individuals who have the same concern that we have regarding militarism and state repression and are very interested in us collectively attempting to try to figure out how we rebuild a Black anti-war presence and then connect that to attempts to revive the anti-war movement in general here in the U.S.
Well, let's talk about the current political environment, the current Black political environment. Not only do we not have a Dr. King today, but we don't have the kind of background politics that Dr. King was responding to today. In those days, we had the experience of SNCC, which came out early against the war. By the time Dr. King gave his speech at Riverside in 1967, we had the beginnings of the Black Panther Party. We had anti-imperialist sentiment and loudly spoken in the United States back then, but not today.
Exactly. And that's one of the reasons why we've had individuals and organizations who are part of what Black Agenda Report very accurately identified as the Black misleadership class, having a free hand to take some of the most backward and even reactionary positions on the state and violence and war that we've ever seen in the history of our people in this country. Yet the political environment has moved dramatically to the right, and that's been reflected also in the politics, the internal politics of the Black community. So one of the things that we want to do is to, in fact, hold these individuals and organizations accountable. It's important that people make a decision in terms of what side are they going to be on. Are they going to be on the side of the imperial power, the congealed expression of institutional white supremacy in the form of the U.S. state as a leader of the pan-European colonial project? Or are they going to stand with the interests of the rest of humanity, the people who are struggling to free themselves up from this insanity? So they got to make a decision. They're going to stand with the people, or they're going to stand with the war machine of this declining state. So we want the members of the Congressional Black Caucus to be clear with their constituents where they stand on the issues of war and peace. We say that basically you cannot pretend that you are concerned about the interests of black people, black lives, while you stand in support of the U.S. state engaging in activities in which the objective value of the lives of black and brown people around the world is quite obvious, that they have no value for the U.S. state, and that is a contradiction for you to pretend otherwise. So we want these black leaders to be upfront with their constituents. You can't pretend to be concerned about black lives and not be concerned about the lives of the people in Yemen or in the Gaza Strip or in the Congo or, in this case, in North Korea, where they are threatening to intensify a conflict. So you have to take a stance. Again, you know, either you're going to support peace and self-determination and the dignity of people, or you're going to stand with this declining white supremacist power.
It does appear that most, if not all, of the Congressional Black Caucus has taken a stand. That is, even stalwarts of what some folks think of as the left or more progressive part of the Congressional Black Caucus, like Maxine Waters, speak constantly, incessantly about Russians, and not about peace, but in fact about stepping up tensions.
Yeah, most of the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, and even many of the leading black organizations, have allowed themselves to be sucked into this Russian gate nonsense that has politically and ideologically aligned themselves with the U.S. state and moved public opinion closer to a position that suggests that conflict with Russia is not only inevitable, but is justified. So again, this is another example of the kind of lack of principles that we see with the so-called leaders. There is a direct connection between that agitation for conflict with Russia and their relative silence, except for a couple of them, on the strike in Syria, and their complete silence also in terms of the saber rattling that we see off the coast of North Korea by the U.S. state. So they are still continuing to paint themselves into ideological and ethical corners by their opportunism. And they are, because of their opportunism and their silence and their collaboration with the U.S. state, they're helping to justify and rationalize the activities of this white supremacist state to their constituents and to the broader black community. That has to be reversed. That kind of collaboration with the greatest purveyor of violence on this planet is not a position that Dr. King, not a position that the progressive and radical movement has ever taken before, and that we've got to reverse that and bring back some sanity and some principles. And there are groups out there that are, in fact, standing up. Right now, they are somewhat fragmented. We want to galvanize these groups and recenter this principled opposition to the violence of the U.S. state, and to remind people again that our struggle in this country has to be fundamentally connected to the struggles of all people who are struggling against oppression globally. That is the black radical tradition, and that's what we hope to try to revive with this Black Alliance for Peace. The tagline of this Black Alliance for Peace is that this is a people-centered human rights project against war, repression, and imperialism. We're going to be clear about those stands. We're not just concerned about domestic U.S. politics. We're concerned about the world. That is our tradition, and that's what we need to re-embrace.
Yes, The Congressional Black Caucus and many of these black civic organizations say that they are involved in an all-out resistance to Trump. But how can they effectively resist Trump's $54 billion increase in the defense budget while whipping up basically an hysteria against Russians and all allies of Russia? Aren't we hearing, or don't they hear, that great sucking sound of that great suction tube that Dr. King talked about, the military-industrial complex, sucking out all of the resources of society towards the dedication to war?
They hear it, but because the Democrat Party is a party that is the liberal expression of the bourgeoisie, because elements of that party are also connected to the military-industrial complex and are the main supporters of that corrupt party, they're not going to reject their paymasters. And they're not going to uphold the principled historic positions of their constituents in the black communities. So we have to make them, in fact, do that. This insane call by the Trump administration for a $54 billion increase in military budget, increase that represents 80% of the total estimated budget of the Russians, who they claim are supposed to be the threat to the U.S., it demonstrates the insanity that we are, in fact, dealing with. And their non-opposition to this call, again, paints them into a political corner, because with their non-opposition and then their support for the strike in Syria and their silence on the militarism of the U.S. state, they are, in fact, creating the political and ideological positions that will allow for the Trump proposal to, in fact, be implemented. We say with the Black Alliance for Peace that not only do we reject the call for the $54 billion increase, we say that the military budget needs to be significantly, dramatically reduced, and that those resources should be transferred to addressing the material needs of the people of this country. It makes no sense for this military, this Pentagon budget with its $596 billion tag to be increased. And then when you connect up the Pentagon budget with the overseas contingency budgets to run the wars, and you connect that to the budgets of the Homeland Security, you're talking about $1.1 trillion of funds that are sucked from the U.S. people into the pockets of this military-industrial complex. So you can't have social justice while you also support militarism. You cannot talk about human rights and upholder of human rights while you involved in the systematic destruction of human rights, the most precious one being the right to life. You cannot pretend to be a supporter of human rights while you also support war. So opposition with BAP, the Black Alliance for Peace, is to try to bring back some kind of sanity into this discussion and to take forthright and principled positions in opposition to this insanity and to demand accountability from those who claim to be the political leaders of African or black people here in this country.
Going beyond black elected officials and the traditional black civic organizations, most of which are embedded in the Democratic Party, what about that movement that is generally referred to as Black Lives Matter? What kind of promise do you see in that part of the landscape in terms of anti-imperialism?
I think that among a number of the black activists who are part of the Black Lives Matter, that there is a growing understanding of the connection between their concerns with domestic repression and the permanent war agenda of the U.S. state, the commitment of this national security state to the use of violence to maintain its hegemony. And so that provides a basis for us to organize politically and to bring those forces together into a more coherent anti-war, anti-repression, anti-imperialist alliance. The fact that some of the elements of the Black Lives Matter movement, the movement for Black Lives, identified with and connected the struggles of African people in the U.S. with the anti-colonial struggles of Palestinian people, provides a basis for us to expand on that understanding. By doing that, they in fact became part of the black radical tradition. So we want to bring those elements into this alliance. We want to connect up with that space and make those positions even more politically apparent, coherent, and directional in terms of some real concrete practice. So we see there's potential there. one of the things that has to happen here in the U.S. is a more explicit politics. So the anti-imperialist component of our concerns as Black people, as Black radicals, we have to make that more apparent, more clear to ourselves and to the people that we are organizing. Because again, we cannot organize and build an effective movement in this country while simultaneously obscuring the objective political interests that are fighting to maintain their hegemony, that the connection between the national security state domestically and the war agenda, the commitment to full spectrum dominance by the U.S. state, they have to be connected. We have to understand that both are the enemies of our people and the enemies of most of humanity.
Yes, isn't it appropriate that those who uphold the Black radical tradition apply something of a litmus test to folks, a litmus test for peace in terms of who's legitimately progressive in Black terms and who's not?
Well, you know, the test has to be who is prepared to oppose in a principled and consistent way the colonial capitalist system and who is not. When you hear so-called Black activists who will make these torturous arguments as to why it's important for the U.S. state under a Trump administration to apply what they call progressive use of force in Syria, those folks have to be called out. They have to be much more clear in terms of where they stand, because you can't pretend that Trump is a neo-fascist on Monday and then Wednesday say that you trust the Trump administration with applying a so-called progressive force in a moral way on Wednesday. I mean, it makes no sense. It's politically inconsistent and ideologically backward. So those elements who have been able to escape serious scrutiny for quite some time because of the relative weakness of our movement here in this country, those folks have to be called out and be accountable to their collaboration with the U.S. state. There is no example that someone can point to me in which the U.S. has been on the correct side of the people since the Second World War. Where? And this notion that this state has the moral responsibility to protect the lives of people in Syria is absolutely absurd. How can you condemn a Trump administration for not admitting Syrians into the U.S. on one day, the next week, you believe that they are really supposed to be concerned about the lives of Syrians? That is perpetuating a ideological fraud on the people of the U.S. So those folks, they have to be called out because they are in their petty bourgeois, comfortable, latte left lifestyles. They've been allowed to pretend to be leftists without any accountability for years. That has to end now. You've got to either step with the people or go ahead and align yourself openly with the powers of white supremacy and imperialism. I want to make sure people are not confused that we're calling for peace because as revolutionaries, we believe in peace. We want people to live with dignity. We want people to live with security. But we also understand, too, that there could be no peace without justice. And so we are prepared to struggle and to fight for peace. So we are not pushing a pacifist position. We understand that for us to be able to realize a decolonial understanding of the potential of human rights, that the people have to fight for their human rights. They have to fight in solidarity with other people who are struggling for their fundamental right to exist and fundamental right to self-determination. So this Black Alliance for Peace is for peace, but we also understand that to arrive at peace, we've got to engage in struggle.
And that means struggling with folks from your own group if they are collaborating with those who are the forces of war.
Exactly. There is no notion that because you happen to be a Black person or African that I'm in fundamental solidarity with you when you are aligning yourself against the people. No. If you align yourself with the people, if you're upholding the interests of the predominant powers, the congealed white supremacist powers, that you are, in fact, an enemy of the people.
Ajamu Baraka will be among the hundreds of peace activists that will descend on Richmond, Virginia, June 16th through 18th, for a national conference of UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition. We spoke with Anna Edwards, a co-founder of the Virginia Defenders, one of the coalition's co-founders. UNAC organizers say this year's conference will host the biggest black presence in the history of the coalition.
Well, that's probably true. I think not since the first conference in 2010 in Albany, when there was a black caucus held that you and I both participated in, has there been a purposeful decision to ensure that black voices on the issue of peace and anti-imperialism plays a very strong role, because it's been classically one of the weaknesses of the anti-war movement to not only be perceived as white, but to consider itself a default within that, and to not understand that around the country there is a long history of activism and engagement, especially on an international basis, by black people against war, for peace, and certainly anti-imperialist and by nature and extension anti-colonial.
There's very little evidence of that history in the behavior of most black elected officials, especially the Congressional Black Caucus, when it comes to Syria, for example.
Well, that's true, but then it's never been in the interest of those who are actually serving in the government, in the mainstream government of the United States, to beat that drum very hard. Because if you're going to be in that system, then you've got to go along with that system to a large extent. I mean, I think that there are places where people have tried to voice opposition, but they only go so far. So the voices that have been strongest have always come from outside of the electoral system.
In general, since 2010, how would you measure the effectiveness and the relative influence of the anti-war movement in these seven past years?
Not effective. I mean, one of the things that the whole movement has been struggling with, and I would say the anti-war movement as well, frankly, as black voices in the black liberation movement, has been fairly silent since the election of Barack Obama. And then since 2010, I think in particular, it's been a stifled voice. To a certain extent, I think the left has not been able to figure out its footing and has been as confused by the explanations of what's been going on in Europe and in Africa and in the Middle East as any other political voice in this country. And the result has been that they have not known how to respond appropriately or effectively, and the end result has been a similar kind of infighting that has not resulted in a strong enough and certainly not a unified presence. Now, I think at the same time, there's been an awareness of that, and people have been actively trying to address that, but it's been very difficult. And it really hasn't been until this election with Trump being elected that people have found a way to begin to galvanize their thinking.
UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, has seemed less confused than others on what's called the left.
And I think that that's because one of the principles that they have held fast to is the principle of the U.S. needing to stay out of other countries' internal struggles. It's allowed them to maintain a kind of perspective that both respects the internal processes of people on the ground struggling to make progress in their own countries versus the battles and the power struggles of their governments. And it's also, I think, UNEC has also been grounded in socialism and a view that it is the people's perspective from which these things need to be analyzed, but you also have to follow the economics and you have to follow the power struggles in order to understand who's doing what to whom and why. And one of the things that we hold clear is that we do operate from the belly of the beast. If the United States is the superpower of the planet, then it is a super responsibility on the part of the left to understand exactly how the U.S. is playing out its agenda around the world, whether it's in the guise of humanitarian activities or fighting terrorism or fighting the drug war or whatever they call it. It isn't that different from both the missionary and the colonial expeditions and ventures of 300 years ago.
The new presence on the scene since 2010, appearing in 2014, is the Black Lives Matter movement. What's its relationship to the struggle for peace?
That's probably the most important thing that's happened, in that it starts on such a localized level in a way, in terms of addressing, you know, extrajudicial killings of Black people and the rate at which Black people are being killed either by the police or those people not being held responsible for those deaths. But the fact that those things could be considered very local events, but that are happening all over the country and at such a rate. There was one report that was able to do the data collection to identify that one Black person was being killed every 28 hours. And that was an incredibly important report. And it's interesting, too, that that was an instance of where it's Black researchers putting together a report that was of significance to the Black community. It goes national, it goes international, and people understood the impact of that. The riots that began to take place triggered old fears and sent old understood warning signals across the country about what it means to have an unhappy, super disenfranchised Black community finally beginning to rise up and fight back. This is one of the oldest fears that this country understands all too clearly, because you can read the legislation, you can read the news editorials going back, again, almost 300 years on this issue. And therefore, its resonance was such that when it built and when there were enough people, some of the organizers of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors in particular, I remember, was at one of the early Black Left Unity Network conferences, which sought to put together a mechanism by which the Black liberation movement could be revitalized by understanding the historical context. So these are people who have been working already on these issues on a local basis, but have understood the implications on a national and international basis, and so have been able to draw the connections between what's happening in the Black community in the United States and what's happening in oppressed communities around the world. So the Black Lives Matter movement becomes a real marker, and probably the first time since the Black Liberation Movement of the 1970s that there is a kind of a force. It's got its challenges as well, but it's become the kind of a beacon that's allowed a lot of room, not a single room, but lots of individual rooms for people to have complex conversations that they haven't in a while and find traction.
And yet this discussion, which involves anti-imperialist discussion, hasn't seemed to have had much of an effect on those folks who've been elected to represent Black folks.
Well, I think this is all very much in motion. And I think that the folks who have been elected to this point are, in a way, kind of the last of a guard that has sort of been reaching this point where they've been thinking about their legacies more than they've been thinking about planning. And here in Richmond, we kind of went through a very interesting election at the same time that the national election was going on, in that we had a Black mayor who had followed a Black mayor, and that one was L. Douglas Wilder, who had been the first elected governor of a state in the country in several decades. And then he was followed by Mayor Dwight Jones, who was a pastor. He had been a delegate and decided to run for mayor. His tenure had become very problematic because he and a lot of the folks working with him were doing exactly that. They were kind of solidifying the Black Democratic power in the city of Richmond in such a way as to basically protect itself from having to do anything that was truly productive for the Black community. And they were willing to make the deals with white economic power in the city to ensure that what they wanted to get done would get done. What they didn't expect was that a grassroots effort that was equally as purposeful would challenge them to the extent that they would fail in one of their primary objectives, and that was a $385 million stadium development in the historic part of Richmond. There is a new generation of people coming in that are going to be both problematic, and some of them are going to open doors that have not been seen before. Things are in motion. There's a transition going on between how business has been done by our Black and white politicians up to this point on the local scene and how they are going to be doing business going forward. At this moment, what that means for war and peace is not clear. I don't know that it's going to change much in that direction. That part is really hard to say because the United States' agenda around the world doesn't necessarily seem to be changing just because the people's general characteristics seem to be changing. But there is a shift. There is a shift, and it may have some more profound effect on a local level.
And how is the UNEC conference proposing to change the U.S. agenda around the world?
UNEC is proposing with this conference to bring together and synthesize voices that have been considered the default voices of anti-war thinking, along with more dynamic and what have been considered lesser known voices of anti-war thinking from the Black community, from the Black left, and from other peoples of color. I think there's been a much stronger focus on the fact that the white movement has not been strong enough, it has not been effective, and it tends to think that it's the center of gravity, that there have been critical Black voices that have been involved in anti-war and anti-imperialist efforts in this country and outside of this country. Many people don't know how many organizations led by Black voices have participated in United Nations conversations, have participated in international conferences on women's rights, on race, on slavery and human trafficking. Many people don't know how active and dynamic organizations that aren't even based in the United States but have an effect here are. And I'm encountering them on a regular basis. And it's going to be imperative, and I think that this UNAC conference is going to be bringing voices like Maurice Carney from the Friends of the Congo, who are going to be able to give insight into what else is going on and the ways in which folks on the left in the U.S. can be working with them in order to break this open a little bit more. And literally, we are coming to understand a little bit better exactly the way in which the left is beginning to mobilize using social media in order to strengthen networks that are international and getting information more quickly and being able to organize on issues that have a direct impact both locally and internationally. This is not focused on Africa. This is focused on Eastern Europe. But my husband, Phil, and I were in Eastern Europe last spring at a conference called the Social Forum of Eastern Europe and North Africa and found that there were people there who were very actively engaged in fighting right-wing and proto-fascist tendencies. And those powers have been rising significantly since then. And since the overthrow of the Ukrainian government, I think in 2014, I remember attending a conference in New York City back in 2008, I think it was. It was the Organization of Women Writers of Africa, and it brought together 2,000 women of the African diaspora to this conference. And they were writers, they were artists, they were activists, they were educators, and they came from countries all over Europe, all over Asia, Africa, the United States. And one of the women was a Black woman who was in Russia. And one of the things that she warned about at that time was that David Duke had left the United States from his Klan activities and white supremacist activities in Louisiana and had gone to set up a base in Russia, and that he was actively engaged in building and promoting right-wing nationalism and ethno-nationalism as a tool for destabilization there and for building a power base. So this is something that we are very much connected to, and we see that the voices who are starting to understand that will be at the UNAC conference, and we'll be able to talk about the different ways in which the United States has a clear responsibility and the left in the United States has a clear responsibility and opportunity to build momentum, to build understanding about this involvement, and to begin to discuss how to take it on. And not just to discuss it. I mean, one of the things that's going to be very important is that what comes out of this conference are some clear steps for taking action. And those steps will have to be things that people can do as individuals, but also collectively as organizations and as networks.
You seem to be saying that UNAC is intent upon becoming more embedded in the various peoples across ethnic lines, not just in the United States, but around the world, who have an interest in ending war.
I think that UNAC has come to the realization that they have to do that. When UNAC got together, I think that the principal point was to sort of rebuild the idea that mass movements and mass demonstrations were still an important part of protesting against war and against imperialism. But I think that they have learned over these last 10 years that that's part of the tool chest. Right, is mass demonstrations are a key part of the tool chest. But if the movement and if this particular network is not paying attention to what contributes to the need for those mass demonstrations and is not continuing to educate itself on what the causes are and playing an active role in extending the education and in supporting people's struggles here and abroad, then it's just another conference. You know, it's just another group that talks to itself and is not going to be any more effective than any other temporary formation. And, you know, one of the other components that I think is lending a certain sense of urgency, one is people are frightened by the idea that we are talking about fascists in a very tangible way. The other thing is that people have accepted the fact that our world is literally in danger from climate change. And that's putting a kind of end date. There's a possibility that we have an end date for civilization as we understand it on this planet because of the ways in which imperialism is being played out environmentally. And so I think that there's this combination of the Black Lives Matter movement making the fundamental contradictions of United States ideology and identity a critical issue, clearly recognizable by all Americans, and also obvious to people outside of the United States. You combine that with an understanding of the way that this ethno-nationalism is on the rise around the world, and the idea that the planet might actually become utterly inhospitable to human growth in the very near future. And you've got a kind of a stew that's simmering to a boil. And if we don't stop acting like we can just live with it, we will be responsible. And if we have grandchildren, they will know.
That was Anna Edwards of the Virginia Defenders and the United National Anti-War Coalition, speaking from Richmond.
Cynthia McKinney was one of the most consistent advocates of peace during her 6 terms as a congresswoman from Georgia. She's now teaching political science overseas. McKinney says her former party, the Democrats, have become the most aggressive advocates of war.
I'm almost speechless at what the Democratic Party has become, because whoever would have thought that the most rabidly pro-war, pro-military, banking, media, financial, military, industrial complex would be the Democratic Party. It seems to have flipped totally 180 degrees from what one would think the Democratic Party stood for. So you could say that there's been a flip-flop. There's been a switching of positions. Whatever it is, it's disquieting. And for me, it's unacceptable. It's unacceptable, not just that this is the position of the Democratic Party, which has become a pro-war party, but it's also unacceptable that what is characterized as the left is not really the left. Because of the propaganda, the idea of what is left and what is right and who gets to be called left, I think is up for grabs now, because the left is being defined as people who supported Hillary Clinton. But of course, I didn't support Hillary Clinton, don't support Hillary Clinton, don't support more and more war. And so therefore, what is characterized as left is not, in my opinion, left. I say that those who support the war machine are not left.
And certainly this was disturbing, given that historically, Black America has been the most anti-war, the most opposed to U.S. military adventures and attacks overseas of any constituency in America. And yet we see the Congressional Black Caucus, to a man and to a woman, constantly harping on the Russians and blaming them, well, for the loss of the election in 2016 and now for every atrocity that's been committed in the world.
Well, the Russians are a convenient scapegoat for a political party that has run away from its base and at the same time has assumed a new identity. That new identity, as I said before, is one that runs away from matters of truth, matters of justice, matters of peace. No, we're not going to have any of that because that's not where the money is. So basically what we have is a Democratic Party that dresses itself in the suit of peace, justice, truth, dignity, environmentalism, but in actuality, it's wearing the clothes of warmonger, representative of the military-industrial complex. Unfortunately, it's my opinion that we also are seeing a propagandized version of what is left versus what actually is left. And I use myself as a gauge. I say I'm the left. And the reason I say I am the left is because I'm anti-war, I'm pro-peace, I'm pro-social justice, I'm pro-truth, I'm pro-human and environmental dignity. I understand exactly what it is that I'm in favor of. Those things that I'm in favor of haven't changed for the entire time that I have been in public life. What did change was the political party from which I was elected and served 12 years in the Congress. Basically, what I did was I took a principles inventory of what was important to me and what were the values that were important to me. The inventory led me to realize that the Democratic Party is not where I am, and the Democratic Party is not really where liberals, progressives, however you want to characterize people who think like us or people who think like me, that we follow the principles and not the personalities. So the principles have remained the same. What has changed is the political party and the propaganda that backs the party.
I guess the real question, however, is this indicative of any change in the Black body politic? Just because these Black Democrats have gone to the right, is that an indication that Black folks have abandoned their historical anti-war stance?
Well, that may have been an anti-war stance that was historical before the arrival of Barack Obama on the scene, but I've never seen quite so many progressives that fail to speak out against the various insults that took place on the African continent and in Asia as well. So whether it was supporting war as an energy policy, supporting the bombing of Somalia, what happened with Libya is a travesty that some of us, at least that I continue to have to live with, also as a point of shame. It seems to me that the members of the Congressional Black Caucus ought to have some shame about the state of Black America, U.S. foreign policy, some sense of responsibility for what has been wrought with their support in their name. But when I was in the Congress and complaining about the failure of the Congressional Black Caucus around Hurricane Katrina, that I was told by one member there that, Cynthia, you just have to understand that when the leadership tells us to do something, we're going to do it. That's a direct quote. And then when it came to taking care of U.S. foreign policy, particularly U.S. Africa policy, I distinctly remember one member saying, I represent this area and I don't represent that area. And this was a Black member of Congress who was speaking specifically about a area that was represented by a Black member of Congress. So if we can't count on our elected officials, I guess I need to use Trump and say the swamp. Our elected officials are supposed to pull the plug and drain the swamp. They're not supposed to enjoy the murkiness of the swamp. They're supposed to clean up the swamp. And that's what I expect to be done. But so far, no such luck.
Not one member of the Congressional Black Caucus has failed to toe the line without evidence that Syria and Russia were behind the chemical event in Idlib province just a couple of weeks ago, the pretext for the bombing of that Syrian Air Force base. None of them even question that official story.
Well, you're talking about Syria, but Somalia was bombed for 8 years under President Obama. Nobody said anything. Libya was totally destroyed, and Denis Kucinich was the one who raised his voice. And so what we have is basically a dereliction of duty. But, you know, Nita Loy, the congresswoman from New York, when it became known that I had been targeted for removal from the Congress by AIPAC and the much larger than AIPAC Israel lobby, came to me personally and told me, Cynthia, every vote has a consequence. And so what I would say is that now, unless we make sure that there's a consequence for these votes for war and votes for the military, industrial, banking, financial, media complex, then nothing is going to change. Really, the change that is expected must come from us. And that means that we have to challenge in the field of electoral politics. We have to challenge on that playing field those who don't abide by our values, our wishes, our policies, our preferred policies, and ultimately our principles, what it is that we stand for. Our ideal is far from being realized because we have not forced a consequence on those who represent us. How long ago was it? 50 years ago that Malcolm X said that we're political chumps? If we go around and we are so proud to be of a political party that delivers nothing to us, and we have the power to determine, as Malcolm said, who sits in the White House and who stays in the doghouse, we do have that power. We had it when Malcolm was talking, and we have it even more acutely now. But we're not exercising the power that we have. And is that a failure of the leadership? Yes, but it's also a failure of the grassroots, because 50 years ago, it was the leadership combined with the grassroots that demanded change, and change was brought about. But of course, that change wasn't going to last, because what Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was challenging was the deep state. Now we all know what the deep state is. And that's exactly what Dr. King was challenging. That's what Malcolm was challenging. That's what, for that matter, JFK and RFK and the Black Panthers and the American Indian Movement and all the people who were subjected to the rogue use of U.S. governmental power were challenging the deep state. So who's doing that now? Who's going to do that now? That's what I was trying to do But it's impossible to do that. You have to have the combination of the inside game and the outside game. You got to have those who are in those positions of power, and you've got to have those outside those positions of power bolstering those who are on the inside. And there's got to be this synchronicity. There's got to be this harmony so that when one gets hit hard, the other one steps up. And so that score, a musical score, where the orchestra has one role and the voice has another role. And so you've got all of these different players that have to be melded together in a way that produces the result. And what COINTELPRO has successfully done, targeted assassination exists because it works. Infiltration exists because it works. And so these tactics that we know were used and continue to be used by the U.S. government continue to be used because they work. Now, who's going to do the heavy lifting of the organizing? It can't come from a Soros pocketbook. It has to come from the pain of the people who are affected.
What's your assessment of the status of the anti-war movement, or is there one?
I don't think there's an anti-war movement any longer. And for various reasons, I think you hit the nail on the head, Glenn, when you said that Barack Obama was the most effective evil. And so one of the results of that evil is that we no longer have a peace movement, period. It's the same old people with the same old voices showing up in the same old places every time, except I'm not there because I had to get out of town. And so without an effective peace movement, how can we have peace? I also want to say that it's easy to blame the Russians because the Democratic Party has been captured by a particular special interest that pays all of its bills. And that special interest is in no way, shape, or form ready to relinquish its control over what it has won. And so therefore, the Democrats have to find something, some excuse for their dismal behavior, because change isn't on the table. Change isn't in the books. Change is not one of the plays in the playbook. So now, what has happened in the Black community as microcosm has happened in the so-called progressive community in macrocosm. The geostrategy that has evolved as a result of U.S. aggression, supported by the U.K. and Western Europe, is that now you've got Russia, China, and Iran all on the same page. And so what you're talking about is destruction that could come to the homeland. The U.S. will suffer a consequence in this big war. And if they think that they can manage the tension so that there will be a cold war where the military, industrial, banking complex, all of that media, all of that congressional complex gets to fatten itself without a hot war, I just remind folks to go back and read the book, The Guns of August, where power stumbled into World War I. And you could very easily stumble into a hot war because of the consequence of people who are masters of war now in charge of the U.S. government. They're in charge of the deep state. And of course, as long as the deep state has control over the U.S. government, they've got control over the government. So basically, the best friend of the people of the United States will be those people who array themselves in such a way as to challenge the deep state.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.